Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. Books.
Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and today my guest is one of my favorites, Nicole Krauss, whose new book, Forest Dark, has just appeared. There's a note that explains that Forest Dark is the way Longfellow translated the opening of Dante's Inferno. Most of the translations say dark wood. I came to myself in the middle of my life, awakened in a dark wood. And I wondered, what made you choose the Longfellow translation?
Well, I think that when you keep the order of the Italian, the selva scura, there's something more evocative there. Dark wood is fine, but forest dark somehow opens to what was important to me in writing this book, which is the forest as a place of mystery, of the unknown, outside the realm of human order, outside of rational knowledge, a place to get lost in.
One of the two major protagonists of this book, Jules Epstein, he realizes that he hadn't realized that a forest is for rest. And he needs rest. He's lived a preposterously busy life, and he has decided to give away what he owns. Art pieces, he has his own personal Matisse. Money, he'll give it to organizations. He doesn't want to be what he was anymore. Not the two-fisted man capable of speaking at a moment's notice, enforcing his opinions. These characters, both of them, have a hunger to be something other than what they've been. So now he is in a forest, or at least he thinks he is. He's looking to dedicate something, a monument of some kind, to his parents. He traveled to Israel, so I thought I'd ask you to read, Nicole, the beginning of this vision that he has when he's in Israel. Where is he in Israel?
Well, he goes from New York to the Tel Aviv Hilton, where he checks in. But very soon after that, he sort of falls out of that hotel, that enormous grid-like structure that's cantilevered on the shore of the Mediterranean with all of its certainty. And he ends up in this tiny, broken down apartment in Jaffa. He decides to stay, as it were. And his thoughts turn increasingly toward the mystical, toward the unknown, a man of certainties who gives up his certainty. But I'll read you this short section, which is when, as you said, Epstein is already in Israel, and he's gone through all the various meetings with all the various institutions that would like to have his money to do something in memory of his parents, and none of them are right, and none of them are right. And finally, this happens. Epstein dreamed he was walking through an ancient forest. It was cold, so cold that his breath hung frozen in the air. The black needles of the pine trees were dusted with snow, and the air was fragrant with resin. Everything was dark. The damp ground, the great high boughs of the trees bathed in muted cloud light, the bark, the cones hanging on above, all except for the white snow and the pair of red slippers on his feet. Surrounded by the tall trees, he felt a sense of being protected, safe from anything that might wish to harm him. There was no wind. The world was still, a stillness very close to joy. He walked a long time, the snow crunching under his feet, and only when he stumbled on a root across the path did he look down and recognize the slippers. Of red felt brought by his mother's cousin from Europe, more beautiful than functional, the soles so thin that they barely did their work of protecting his feet from the cold below. The sensation of seeing something long forgotten but intensely familiar washed over him, and in that instant it dawned on him that he hadn't grown up after all. Somehow, unknown to everyone, most of all to himself, he'd remained a child all this time. At last he came to a clearing, and in the center of the glade he saw a stone pedestal. Bending, he brushed away the snow, and the golden letters appeared under his fingers frozen with cold, in memory of Saul and Edie, the sun and the earth. When he woke, a shivering Epstein discovered that he had sweated through the sheets. He stumbled through the hotel room and turned off the icy blast from the air conditioner. Pulling back the heavy drapes, he saw that it was already morning. He slid open the glass door to the terrace and a warm breeze floated in, carrying the sound of breaking waves. He felt the sun on his skin and inhaled the salty air. In damp pajamas, he leaned over the railing, squinting at the oily light that sat heavily on the surface of the water. He thought about swimming again. It would feel good after the strange intensity of the last days. He thought again of the Russian who'd pulled him out from under the waves, who had only laughed and clapped him on the back when he'd offered remuneration, and told him that if he stayed out of the water, it would be payment enough. But why shouldn't he go back in again? On the contrary, it was exactly because he had nearly drowned that he should now march right back into the sea before there was a chance for the fear to gather tension and solidify into an impasse. He was a strong swimmer, had always been a strong swimmer. This time he would pay more attention, and anyway, the water was calmer today, the black flags gone.
I love the way in this book there's so much visionary experience. We should be alert. After all, he's in Israel. It's hot, but he's in the snow in his dream. We only find out it's a dream at the beginning of the second paragraph. It's the dream that will lead him to making a monument for his parents. What Epstein comes to know is that he will know the right place when he sees it. That what has been in his dreams is now carried through in life. And the book is full of imagined moments that are beyond reason. While it is true, I gather, that a good deal of Kafka's unpublished material is the subject of an ongoing legal case.
Finally finished now in the Supreme Court of Israel, yes.
Very recently.
Very recently in June.
Yes. Max Brod, Kafka's friend, had all these papers. He left them to the woman who was his lover. The state of Israel believed that Kafka, being the greatest writer of his century and a very great Jewish writer, that these papers, unpublished, should belong to the state, to the state of Israel's library, and the woman who inherited them believes that they belong to her.
The daughter of Esterhoff.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah, I mean that, well, there's so much to say about all of that. One is that I used to walk by that apartment on Spinoza Street in Tel Aviv that Eva Hoff lives in, along with about 30 stray cats, which you can smell from the outside, you know, when you stand there and you see the bars and that ground floor apartment. And I used to walk by and think, what is inside there? You know, is it something of the original Kafka that is entrapped within? Is it us who are entrapped on the outside from touching what we long for? You know, anyone who loves Kafka, just like anyone who loves Bruno Schultz or any other writer of whom there is lost material, unread lost material, we long for it. We want to know what was it, what's there. And there's just this enormous yearning for that. And I used to stand there and think about that. And the more I thought about entrapment, the more I thought about the flip side of that, which is escape, the idea of escape. And I feel that the story that Max Brod gave to us of Kafka is a construct, as all narratives of our constructs, but it's a construct about a martyr, about a saint who ultimately died of all of the things he couldn't escape from: the overbearing father, the tuberculosis, the inability to write, all of the conditions of life, a body and a spirit not made, so to speak, for this world. That's what Brod would say. But no, you read Kafka and you cannot help but feel that this is somebody who fundamentally escaped.
The person who is fascinated by the possibility that Kafka escaped and lived in Palestine is Nicole. She isn't specifically identified with my guest, Nicole Krauss, but she bears enough in common so that we wouldn't be ashamed of ourselves if we make that identification. But what I want to say, and I have the feeling it's true for you too, since you mentioned Bruno Schultz, and I bet you would mention Robert Walser too, is that the Kafka that Max Brod gave us, which includes the trial and the castle, I would like to say is not the real Kafka. The real Kafka is in Josephine the Mouse Singer and the investigations of a dog and the burrow, his extraordinary relation to the imagination of animals and to things. Everyone likes to pretend that Kafka was absolutely unique, but he had many writers that he loved, including Robert Walser, including E.T.A. Hoffman.
Including Midrashic stories.
Of course.
I would add to your list of the sort of less than overly celebrated Kafka, the Zurau aphorisms, which contain his writings about the fall of man, which Kafka himself, modest as he was, thought that he understood better than anyone, and I tend to agree with him. I mean, he really understood this idea that, you know, we weren't exiled from the Garden of Eden because we ate from the tree of knowledge. It was because we didn't eat from the tree of life, and had we eaten from the tree of life, we would understand that we each contained this spark of the eternal.
There's a secret literature, the literature of the otherworldly, that's very, very important. And I think that my guest, Nicole Krauss, is describing in Forest Dark the part of our lives where we enter the otherworldly, where loss, in Nicole's case, in the book of a marriage, in the case of Epstein, his parents, propels us into a world that doesn't have the things that made the world our world. And Nicole Krauss, my great friend and wonderful writer, suggests that fiction itself is the occasion for us to understand the multiverse, the universe side by side with ours, in which the things that have not happened have happened, in which the things that have happened have not happened here, and that we're always dealing with that the nature of the mind, the imagination carried by the heart, is to see that these multiverses are coupled together, that they are within one another and constant, and that we all have within us, as is central to the spark, the possibility of creating a multiverse.
And those of us who are readers and have been readers all our lives, whether we're writers or not, we know that to be fundamentally true, because every time we dip into a great book that changes us, we are dipping into those multiverses. We are dipping into this feeling that one life is not enough. One life does not authentically describe us. It's too small for us. And each time we read or write, we are expanding our sense of being. We become characters, we enrich, we enlarge. And then we return out of the book to this world with its so-called hardened laws of reality, and we feel they're too thin, they're not accurate, they don't accurately describe us. And it's within the realm of literature and art that we feel there's some truer vision of the infinite. And once you begin to touch it, you go back again and again there. That's what makes us, I think, fundamentally readers.
I think so. And yet, of course, there are other kinds of readers. There are other kinds of readers who want to read about the world they know, who want to read, say, Sister Carrie, about the dire straits that a young woman can find herself in when she has no resources. This is another world of fiction, and it's a very ripe world. Russian literature is full of it. American literature is full of it. But you and I think, if we were children reading, we loved Oz.
I think this particular kind of imagination we're talking about, that is open to the otherworldly, is also connected deeply to childhood, which is something that I have always felt talking to you and your imagination, even in this reading that you selected, which I love. It is about the continuous, unbroken connection to being a child.
His realization that he's still a child. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Nicole Krauss about her book, Forest Dark. We'll continue after this short break.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, this is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Nicole Krauss about her latest novel, Forest Dark, the story of two people on the cusp of monumental changes and who find themselves at discovery's door of self, of each other, and of life's possibilities. I must add that these two people never meet. In fact, you know, I would say that it belongs, Forest Dark, to the great tradition of novels with major characters who never meet. You took a characteristic risk. I think you didn't know whether these characters would meet, and I think you didn't know how or if these concerns would come together on anything more than a metaphysical level. So you were imagining a multiverse where something that doesn't happen in this world is postulated for another world, but not quite known.
Well, years of now writing novels in that fashion of existing, dwelling for a long period in uncertainty, that kind of Keatsian negative capability, has taught me that jumping off is always, that risk pays off at the end, that to not know and to simply write with instinct, seeking out the accident, you know, it's the difference between a divine plan and natural selection. I'm a natural selection novelist in that I follow the accident, and it always leads me to something more interesting than I could have imagined. It's like what Joseph Brodsky used to say about the rhyme. He used to tell me that the rhyme is always more intelligent than you are. That's why he felt that you should write in meter so you knew what you were being free from later. And I think that's true not only in poetry, that in a sense the language is more intelligent than you. It takes you to places you would not otherwise have gotten to. And in this case, these stories, these parallel stories, are, in my mind, constantly in conversation, touching, creating echoes and patterns between each other. And that meaning, that subtle meaning that's created there, is to me far more authentic, it feels so to me, than if I were to spell it out in a kind of more linear, plodding fashion.
Now, Nicole has Kafka as a sort of guardian figure, but Epstein's guardian figure is King David, and it's literally so. It's said that King Saul slayed thousands and King David slayed tens of thousands. So as a warrior, Epstein is a David figure, but what he loves as David is that David is known best for the Psalms.
That's right.
For his poetry.
Yes, it's so when early on in the book, when Epstein is in New York, he goes to this luncheon at the Plaza Hotel, which is for Jewish figures to meet Abbas, and who's about to give a speech at the Security Council in the UN. And he meets there, Epstein meets there, this Rabbi Klausner. And at the end of it, Klausner comes up to him and says, "We've met before." Epstein doesn't remember. And he says, "Epstein, well, you know that you come down directly in the lineage from King David. Epstein is one of those names, like Diane, like Abravanel, that is linked directly to King David." And Epstein laughs at first. He scoffs at this idea. But slowly and surely, it begins to settle into his consciousness, and he begins to see himself, almost unknown to himself as it's happening, see himself in that shape of King David. And who was King David? Right, King David was this warrior, this, you know, this manipulative, magnetic, beloved man who, at the end of his life, we the Jews ascribe to him some of the most beautiful poetry ever written, the Psalms. So he sort of stumbles into grace in our sort of version of the story of David. And so without meaning to, Epstein, who gets this reflection from Rabbi Klausner of "you come down from David," his life begins to mirror in certain ways David's. He has a Bat Sheva moment. He has, you know, those things. And I think that is true of all of us who grow up reading. We read the Bible stories. We're named after David or Devorah or Rachel or whatever it is. We read Odysseus, and we get these ideas about what it is to be human.
There is such a thing as poetry in prose. Recently, when I was telling a dear friend about the feelings of losing my parents, he said to me, "Oh, Michael, you might not want to read the poetry of Rilke right now. It might be too strong. But can I suggest you read the eighth of Rilke's Letters to a Young Poet? It's about loss and grief." And so I went to it, and oh boy, you know, it's really great. But I think that what you are doing is working within the tradition of poetic prose, that this often involves, among other things, otherworldliness, a sense of being able to travel in the realms of gold, as Keats puts it. And I think one of the interesting things about Forest Dark is, this was said by Peter Orner in a rather intelligent review in the New York Times that you don't take any easy routes. Uncertainty, not knowing, as Donald Barthelme called it, not knowing is the essence of this book. And we read it. Sometimes it was so beautifully written that I didn't know what it was saying. I was in a trance. I was, you know, moving. I was being moved by a writer who I feel kind of sure didn't know what she was saying necessarily either. It was being led like a seance. And it's really exciting to witness prose going wherever it wills.
Yeah, well, I feel this book was written in some response to living in a world in which information and the rational is so valued above all else. It's almost become a religion, and there's less and less space for communion with the unknown, and the unknown is increasingly conflated with ignorance, when it isn't at all. It's something far more profound and extraordinary, and it's something that for ages has always been a place where humanity could go, you know, whether in some kind of ritualized way, whether in poetry or whether it was for people in religion or whatever it was. And it was consolation. It was also, you know, anxious. The unknown is always a place of deep anxiety. But to sit in it, to dwell in it, is always to arrive at something else, some kind of awe or wonder. And that is something whose value I feel we need to turn back to, I want to turn back to. And so this book became about being in that space.
I've been talking with Nicole Krauss, the author of Forest Dark, published by Harper. Thank you, Nicole, for joining me. It's always a pleasure. You don't get here frequently.
Thank you so much for having me. I love talking to you.
You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from Forest Dark at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. My co-producers are the beloved Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is associate producer, also beloved. The technical director is the beloved Mario Diaz. And special thanks to my assistant, the beloved David Sobel. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mail of Sparks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Stephen Greenblatt is our guest.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.